Hey, hey, how's it going, everybody? I'm a little early today. It's John. I do the 6 o'clock news, but it's only 5:30. What do you care? You're not listening live anyway. I got things to do. Got places to go. Got articles to read. So today the news is at 5:30 instead of 6. Can you handle it? Can you handle it? I sure hope so. Iraq body count for today, according to IraqBodyCount.net. Number of civilians reported killed by military intervention in Iraq, minimum 28,065. Maximum 31,653.
If you want to find out what's going on the world, there are a number of vantage points. A good one is to ask where the arms are, where the military forces are, the arms, the military training, and so on. Now, that happens to be an easy question for us to answer, because it's mostly here. You know, we have good information about it. It's one of the good things about the country is that it's unusually free and providing information. By far, the biggest military forces in the world are in the United States. In fact, overwhelm the rest of the world together. The flow of arms in the world is mostly from the United States, overwhelmingly from the United States, mostly from the United States. If we look where it's going, we can get a good sense of many of the important things happening in the world. If we look where it's going, if we look where it's going, if we look where it's going, 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 going. Regularly, most of the arms flow is to Israel and to Egypt, secondarily to Egypt. So that's in a category by itself. Now that has to do with the world's energy resources and making sure that they're controlled by U.S. energy corporations. Controlled by U.S. energy corporations. Making sure that they're controlled. Take that, put that category aside and ask who's in the lead. Well, in 1999, Colombia took first place. It moved into the lead in receiving the military aid and training from the United States. It had been the leading recipient of U.S. arms and training in the Western Hemisphere throughout the 1990s. It has also had the worst human rights record by far in the Western Hemisphere during these years. The worst human rights record. The worst human rights record. The worst human rights record by far. That correlation is one of the best correlations in contemporary history. There has been an extremely close correlation between U.S. military aid and torture and terror and massacre. Torture and terror.
Thank you.
society, you'd be studying this in elementary school, certainly in college. It's a very important correlation that should be known and understood by the people who are paying for it. The people who are paying for it. The people who are paying for it. People like us. And the correlation remains, and it'll get worse.
Yeah. Fun with Noam Chomsky. There's a little song I made called Chomsky Sings the Blues. I hope you enjoyed it. I sure did. Hey, everybody needs to go to the gas station on the southwest corner of Vermont and Oakwood, because the vanilla nut coffee there is incredible. Freaking out. Sitting here all alone in the Kill Radio studio, reading the news. I got all sorts of stuff for you today. Not really. I got some stuff. I got tons of mom's emails. My mother sends me all the great editorials from New York Times and so forth. Let's start with some talk about Abramoff. I don't know if anybody saw the Golden Globes. I watch it for the dresses. Wow. George Clooney winning for Syriana. Took a few pot shots at Jack Abramoff, asking why any parent would name their baby Jack when their last name ends in off. And he thanked Jack Off for his award. I thought that was quaint. Headline news today, White House silent on Abramoff meetings. I mean, is that a shocker or what? This, according to the Associated Press. All right, you ready for this? Here it goes. Can everybody hear me? Are we streaming? Hello? Hello? The White House is refusing to reveal details of tainted lobbyist Jack Abramoff's visits with President Bush's staff. Abramoff had, quote, a few staff-level meetings, end quote, at the Bush White House. Presidential spokesman and sock puppet Scott McClellan said Tuesday, but he would not say with whom Abramoff met, which interests he was representing, or how he got access to the White House. Probably got access to the White House the same way everybody else does. Through leaks. Whatever happened to Robert Novak, anyway? I miss that guy. What an ass. Since Abramoff pleaded guilty 2 weeks ago to conspiracy, mail fraud, and tax evasion charges in an influence-peddling scandal, McClellan has told reporters he was checking into Abramoff's meetings. I'm making sure that I have a thorough report back to you on that, he said in his press briefing January 5th. And I'll get that to you, hopefully very soon. Please don't hurt me. Man, what I wouldn't give to go back to high school, find Scott McClellan, and beat him up. McClellan said Tuesday that he checked on it at reporters' request. What a nice guy, but wouldn't discuss the private staff-level meetings. Because when crimes are committed, that's a private affair. We are not going to engage in a fishing expedition, he said. With the Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, along with three other Democratic senators, wrote Bush a letter Tuesday asking for an accounting of Abramoff's personal contacts with Bush administration officials and acts that may have been undertaken at his request, saying something like, Dear Bush, what gives, yo? The American people need to be assured that the White House is not for sale, they wrote. And if it is for sale, is it a bargain? Is it a fair price? We want to know. McClellan has said Abramoff attended 3 Hanukkah receptions at the White House, Mazel Tov, but corrected himself Tuesday to say there were only 2, in 2001 and 2002. Baruch atah Adonai, motherfuckers. McClellan said Bush does not know Abramoff personally, although it's possible the two met at the holiday receptions and had casual, meaningless sex. Abramoff was one of Bush's top fundraisers, having brought in at least $100,000 for Bush-Cheney 04 re-election campaign and earning the honorary title Butt Pioneer. How does someone give you $100,000 and you don't know who they are? The campaign took $6,000 of the contributions, which came directly from Abramoff, his wife, and one of the Indian tribes he represented, and donated it to the American Heart Association. But the campaign has not returned the rest of the money Abramoff raised. And that's it. That's all they got. That's the whole article. Let's play a little media file. I haven't seen this, so we're going to watch it together. This is apparently from CNN. This is our old crazy friend Howard Dean talking to Wolf on CNN. Let's see if this little fucker will play. And let's see what they have to say. And then I'll talk to myself about it, and you'll listen. And we're buffering. And
there we go. Well, I laid out a strategy that I thought would make the war on terror winnable. We need to win the war on terror. We have to protect ourselves. The question is, do we have the kind of leadership in Washington that's going to allow that? There is a plan put together by Lawrence Korb and a fellow by the name of Bruce Katulis, who Lawrence Korb was in the Reagan administration. It's a plan that I think makes a great deal of sense. It's a moderate plan, calls for strategic redeployment of our troops while we're removing them from Iraq. We're keeping them some in the region to fight the terrorism that the president's invasion of Iraq has spawned in Iraq. That's a sensible plan for defending America. Right now, we have a lot of happy talk. We have some, frankly, folks who, frankly, aren't treating our troops properly, not arming them and equipping them properly. That doesn't give me confidence about the leadership in this White House.
Should Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff, who's now pleaded guilty to bribery charges, among other charges, a Republican lobbyist in Washington, should the Democrats who took money from him give that money to charity or give it back?
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person in under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true.
But through various Abramoff-related organizations and outfits, a bunch of Democrats did take money that presumably originated with Jack Abramoff.
That's not true either. There's no evidence for that either. There's no evidence.
Senator, what about Senator Byron Dorgan?
Senator Byron Dorgan and some others took money from Indian tribes. They're not agents of Jack Abramoff. There's no evidence that I've seen that Jack Abramoff directed any contributions to Democrats. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, we got to leave it right there. Howard Dean, the chairman of the Democratic Party, always speaking out bluntly, candidly. Appreciate your joining us on Late Edition.
Thanks, Will. Safe flight back.
Oh, my God.
Thank you very much.
Wow. Wow, they totally stumped him. I wish you could have seen it, but this is radio where you can't see anything. But suffice it to say, Wolf was stumped. So what do you think? He asked him knowingly. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Is it true? Is it true? Is it possible that no Democrats took money from this guy? More importantly, does it matter? Does it really matter? Who knows? Interesting stuff. But that Dean, he's something else. I think he should be, you know, when the Democrats take over again, I'd like to see him as press secretary. I bet he'd be good. Although Sharpton would probably be better. Let's go on to another piece of news. Clinton, the female one, got into a little hot water today, speaking bluntly about the Republican administration. Here's an article that touches on that subject, also from the Associated Press. Senator Hillary Clinton on Monday blasted the Bush administration as one of the worst in U.S. history and compared the Republican-controlled House of Representatives to a plantation where dissenting voices are squelched. Now, there's a word you don't hear a lot. Not plantation, I hear that every other day, but squelched. I can't believe they're making a big deal out of calling this administration one of the worst. The only administration in the history of the country to fucking lose an entire city to a hurricane. Put us in war and cut taxes at the same time. Well, whatever, you don't need to hear it from me. If you're listening to Kill Radio, I might as well just be preaching to the choir. Oh. Speaking during a Martin Luther King Jr. Day event, Clinton also offered an apology to a group of hurricane survivors on behalf of a government that left you behind, that turned its back on you. Her remarks were met with thunderous applause by a mostly black audience in the Canaan Baptist Church of Christ in Harlem. That's a strange place for a mostly black audience. The house, quote, has been run like a plantation, and you know what I'm talking about. And then she kind of put her hand on her hip, moved her head side to side, but without moving her neck. You know what I'm talking about. It has been run in a way so that nobody with a contrary view has had a chance to present legislation, to make an argument, to be heard. We have a culture of corruption. We have cronyism. We have incompetence. I predict to you that this administration will go down in history as one of the worst that has ever governed our country. Wow. She's got balls, that Clinton. A spokeswoman for the White House declined to comment and referred questions to the Republican National Committee. RNC spokeswoman Tracy Schmidt said, on a day when Americans are focused on the legacy of Martin Luther King, Hillary Clinton is focused on the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Touche. You know, actually, speaking of people saying crazy shit, let me see if I can find... Why don't you wait patiently while I look for an article about that wacky, zany mayor of New Orleans and what he said the other day about Chocolate City. No, not the KCRW show, but really about the same point. No. Wow, that didn't stay in the news very long. Nothing. Got nothing here. Nothing here. Let's Google it. Let's see what we got on Google. I don't know. I mean, it probably was a pretty irresponsible thing to say. Probably, but are we making a big deal out of it? It seems that the people who are most upset about it are white people. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly who's supposed to be offended about all this. And I can't find anything on Google either. But, you know, if you watch the news, as I do, then you would have heard the mayor. And he's since apologized. So I think we can let it all go. And the point he's trying to make is that it is a predominantly black city, and that, you know, when it's rebuilt, it will again be a predominantly black city. But, you know, actually, I also understand some of the people who are upset because, you know, there's also white people who live there, and Latinos and Asians and everything, and it's a multicultural city, even though it's predominantly black, and to call it chocolate... may sound funny, but it's probably ill-advised. I don't know. Oh, wait. Oh, I found it. Okay. This is from Reuters. The mayor of New Orleans apologized on Tuesday for saying the hurricane-ravaged city would be rebuilt as a chocolate city and for blaming the storm on the wrath of God over U.S. involvement in Iraq. The chocolate remark, which Mayor Ray Nagin made in a speech on Monday, struck a nerve as racial tensions and concerns loom over proposed plans to rebuild New Orleans from Hurricane Katrina. Several of the hardest hit neighborhoods were mostly black, and many residents have expressed fears that those areas will not be rebuilt, while those with more white residents may be. Before the August 29th storm, New Orleans was about 70% black. If I offended anyone, I sincerely apologize. The mayor, who is black, said on Tuesday. That's what it says. The mayor, comma, who is black, comma, said on Tuesday. I need to be more sensitive and more aware of what I'm saying. I want everybody to be welcome in New Orleans. Black, white, Hispanic, Asian. Did I mention black? Because that's the kind of city that we deserve going forward. I was trying to, and didn't do it very well, to deal with this whole notion, the undercurrent, what's being talked about, and what's being talked about is who is going to come back to New Orleans at the end of the day. Which, you know, presumably is black people. In his speech on Monday, marking the Dr. Martin Luther King holiday, Nagin said, "This city will be a majority African-American city. It's the way God wants it to be. This city will be chocolate at the end of the day." Chocolate! I don't know. Anybody out there more offended by the fact that he's talking about what God wants? Fuck. It bothers me. Who is this God character? And his hatred of vanilla and strawberry and Rocky Road. Shouldn't talk about God when you're in government. I don't, you know, this is obviously nothing compared to that guy we call the president, who looks into people's souls. Well, I'm off track. Other black leaders in New Orleans said they were taken aback by Nagin's remarks. "Everybody's jaws are dropping right now," City Councilman Oliver Thomas told the Times, Picayune newspaper. "Even if you believe some of that crazy stuff, that is not the type of image we need to present to the nation." In his speech, Nagin also said a wrathful God sent the hurricanes. "Surely God is mad at America," he said. "Surely he's not approving of us being in Iraq under false pretense. But surely he's upset at black America also. We're not taking care of ourselves." Then he went on to say, "I'm a shining example of a crazy black person. Just look at me, talking about God. National TV." In his apology, Nagin said, "I said some things that were totally inappropriate. I shouldn't have made any references to God as it relates to this city. In the moment, I got caught up, and it shouldn't have happened." Did I mention I'd been drinking? Nagin also said he has made the chocolate reference several times before, including before Congress. Well, that's certainly encouraging. what a beautiful news day. But enough of that crap. Let's go on to something else. Let's go on to... Oh, wait. What do we have here? Let's see. I'm at truthout.org. That's where I got the Howard Dean Democrats Took No Money from Abramoff thing. Do they have any new films? Nah, nothing I haven't already played. Okay. Ooh, what the hell is that? Oh, no. Okay. Well, let's do Mom's Emails. This is the latest email my mother sent me. This is also from truthout.org. If you're not familiar with truthout.org, I recommend it. They have lots of great articles. This one is called "The New Fascism" by William Rivers Pitt. Tuesday, 17th of January, 2006. And it starts with a quote by Abraham Lincoln, which some of you may recall was a pretty good president. Abraham Lincoln. "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." Abraham Lincoln, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the article. "Say fascism to anyone you meet, and you will conjure images of coal scuttle helmets, of Nazi boot heels clicking in terrible unison down Berlin streets during dark days that only a few remaining among the living remember. Each day, members of the generation that heard those heels for themselves go into the ground, taking with them whispered words of warning. I saw it for myself. They whisper before they pass. See the tattooed number? See this scar? It happened. It was real." "Say fascism to anyone you meet, and you will be greeted with the boilerplate response of the blithely overconfident. Such a thing cannot happen here. This is the United States of America, land of the free and home of the brave. Ours is a nation of laws, of checks and balances, of righteousness and decency. Our laws and traditions stand as a bulwark against the rise of totalitarian madness. Cannot happen here. Thus we are indoctrinated into the school of our own assumed greatness. We must disenthrall ourselves, said Abraham Lincoln, and so we must, because it can happen here. It is already happening. All the parroted recitations of grade school civics cannot erase the fact that a new order is rising. Call it secret fascism, or smiley-faced fascism. Call it a quiet dictatorship. Call it what you like, but it is here with us in America today. And it is growing. To be sure, there are no coal scuttle helmets lined in ranks down our broad avenues, no Tantamakush savaging dissidents, no Khmer Rouge slaughtering intellectuals and herding citizens from cities to die by the millions on roads littered with skulls. The core strength of our new fascism is that it speaks softly. It does not present itself in such an obvious way that those who subsist on the dogmas of our greatness can point and say, "There! There it is! I see it!" This new fascism is not fed only by lies, though to be sure the lies are there in preposterous abundance. This new fascism is fed by myths, our myths, the myths by which we rock ourselves to sleep. This new fascism is in truth an elemental fascism, reborn today by a confluence of events, the diligent work of the few, in combination with the passivity of the many, have brought forth this new order. The writer Umberto Eco, in a 1995 essay titled Ur-Fascism, delineated several core elements that have existed in one form or another in every fascist state in history. Quote, "Parliamentary democracy is by definition rotten because it does not represent the voice of the people, which is that of the sublime leader. Doctrine outstrips reason, and science is always suspect. The national identity is provided by the nation's enemies. Argument is tantamount to treason. Perpetually at war, the state must govern with the instruments of fear. Citizens do not act. They play the supporting role of the people in the grand opera that is the state." Take these one at a time. Quote, "Parliamentary democracy is by definition rotten because it does not represent the voice of the people, which is that of the sublime leader." End quote. George W. Bush has all but gelded Congress in recent months, attaching so-called signing statements to a variety of laws, which state that the president may act beyond the laws whenever he so chooses. The United States, fashioned as a republic, has as its voice the congressional body. This is all but finished. To cement his victory over the parliamentary system, Bush has put forth one Samuel Alito for the Supreme Court, a man who believes in the ultimate power of the one leader over the many. The gelded Congress does not appear able to keep this man from the high court, thus rendering the balancing branches of government into a satellite system of the executive. Next quote. "Doctrine outstrips reason, and science is always suspect." End quote. The supremacy of religious fundamentalism within and without government carries this banner before all others. What is reason in the face of the zealot's faith? Science has become a watered-down vessel for intelligent design, and the incontrovertible truths of empirical data are slapped aside. Spencer Tracy, in the film Inherit the Wind, bellows the warning here. "Fanaticism and ignorance is forever busy and needs feeding, and soon, Your Honor, with banners flying and with drums beating, we'll be marching backward, backward through the glorious ages of the 16th century, when bigots burn the man who dared to bring enlightenment and intelligence to the human mind." Next quote. "The national identity is provided by the nation's enemies." End quote. This has been with us for generations now. Our nation defined ourselves through a comparison to the Nazis, to the Imperial Japanese, and then through decades of comparison to communism. Terrorism has supplanted all of these, hammered into place on a Tuesday in September by the actions of madmen. We are not them. All is justified in the struggle against them, and so we are defined. Next quote. Argument is tantamount to treason. End quote. All one need do to see this in action is spend some hours with the Fox News Channel. Freedom fries. Why do you hate America? You are with us or you are with the terrorists. Watch what you say. Next one. Perpetually at war, the state must govern with the instruments of fear. The manipulation of this population by fear has been ham-fisted, to be sure, but has also been cruelly effective. We do not want the evidence to be a mushroom cloud. Weapons of mass destruction and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, nuclear designs in Iran, plastic sheeting and duct tape, orange alert. Argument becomes tantamount to treason simply because everyone has been made to feel fear at all times. A frightened populace is easily governed, and governs itself. This lesson was well learned in the duck and cover days of the Cold War. Those lessons have been masterfully applied once again. Today, the citizenry polices itself, and the herd moves as one body. Even the surveillance of innocent citizens by the state is brushed off as a necessary evil. Remember, you are being watched. Next quote. Citizens do not act. They play the supporting role of the people in the grand opera that is the state. End quote. Once, we lived by the glorious simplicity of the vote. Casting a ballot was the single most patriotic duty a citizen could perform. An affirmation of all we held dear and true. Today, we live in the nation of the vanishing voter. Power has been so far removed from the people by those with money and influence that most see voting as a waste of time. Add to this the growing control of the implements of voting and vote counting by partisan corporations, and the rule of we the people is left in ashes. We must disenthrall ourselves from the idea that our institutions, our traditions, the barriers that protect us from absolute and authoritarian powers cannot be broken down. They are being dismantled, a brick at a time. The separation of powers has already been annihilated. It is a whispered fascism, not yet marching down your street or pounding upon your door in the dead of night, but it is here, and it is laying deep roots. We must listen beyond the whispered fascism of today to the shouted fascism of tomorrow. We must look beyond the lies and the myths, beyond the dogmas by which we sleep. William Rivers Pitt is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author of two books, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, and The Greatest Sedition is Silence. If anybody wants to check out that article, go ahead. I recommend it. Go to truthout.org. And you can read it. I'm going to end the news early today, because I got to be somewhere. Thank you for joining me, if indeed you did join me, or if you're listening to this downloaded. I guess think about what you heard. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye.